On the docket, Keith Boatright versus Wise County Department of Social Services, Mr. Schlimp and Mr. Quinn. O'Quinn.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Mr. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Kern.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may split your time as you wish. I'll let you decide how you want to do that. Mr. Schlimp, you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Sure, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes.
Yes.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Chuck Schlimp. I am honored to be with my client here today, Mr. Keith Boatright, and his mother made the long trip down from Wise County.
That's
we're happy
trip.
To be here. We're asking that the court reverse the termination of parental rights. Four reasons in the brief. I'm going to focus on two, if I will, today. One is the procedural rule, the 90-day rule, that I believe the court's familiar with in other cases, and a procedural rule with regard to the acceptance and approval of a foster care plan in a order of the circuit court. Now, first of all, our appeal focuses primarily on procedural due process. When Department of Social Services comes in and takes away people's kids, they need to do it according to the strict procedures outlined in the formula in the code. This court has said many times in the Wright versus Alexandria DSS case, in the Strong versus Hampton case, succinctly stated, quoting from Strong, due process demands strict compliance with the statutory framework and the rules.
In this particular instance, the delay beyond the 90 days was at least acceded to, wasn't it? The father or father's counsel said no objection to the continuance, being very cooperative,
right.
I understand that, but isn't that a waiver?
Well, Judge Huff, respectfully, we had a little bit of a problem with understanding where we were at that immediate juncture. The court, the background of the story is I had about four or five different DSS appeals going on at the same time. The circuit court requested that most of those cases be set in December, and this case be set in January. We didn't object when the case was set in January, and then when it appeared that this case was being set, when the department was asking for continuance, then being cooperative before the judge brought it to our attention, this is the first time this thing has been continued. Are you sure? And consulting with my client and realizing that he has constitutional rights to the care and custody of his kids, we objected, and I don't believe that we waived our objection at that point.
Wasn't there a no objection statement to the?
I believe what I said is I don't believe we have an objection generally, but we want to move forward today. And I was trying my best to be cooperative with counsel and say we want this heard. I believe the 90-day rule speaks.
Well, Ms. Lund, let me ask you about that 90-day rule, because I think there's a fundamental problem with the argument. We've actually addressed this identical issue in an unpublished case, Daniels versus Culpeper County DSS. And we recognize the general rule that the word shall is oftentimes not mandatory but merely directory.
Sure.
Directory. And we said in that case, citing Marston, stated more directly, the failure to follow a procedural requirement will not prevent a court from exercising its subject matter jurisdiction unless a party can show some harm or prejudice caused by the failure to follow the procedural requirement.
Sure.
What is the harm or prejudice
well,
here?
A couple ways to respond to that. I have 3 points. The first is this court has never given a published opinion mandating that interpretation of this particular provision. What we have seen, we've seen 3 cases that this has been touched upon. We have the Daniels case, we have the Cook versus Petersburg case, we have the Bandy case that just Judge Anizada was on, and these cases were that generally addressing that very point, the procedural, the directory versus jurisdictional. And while we aren't conceding that this is a a mandatory thing. We do recognize that this is a little bit different than your ordinary continuance. This is a little bit different than your ordinary case. This is involving fundamental constitutional rights. And for the first time, this court needs to speak clearly in a published opinion and say what we believe it is. Those cases...
We have plenty of published cases that talk about the word shall when used in some type of time limitation. And in every one of those cases, we have said that failure of the trial court to follow that directory does not mean that it's subject to reversal, it doesn't have jurisdiction to proceed.
Well, got to look at that in a couple different contexts. One, those cases may not be, and I've not seen one that is, a termination of parental rights case. And this is a constitutional, fundamental constitutional right that you're taking away, and you can't just treat it like any ordinary, normal shall. Second, it's in a statute that's titled jurisdiction. And so that kind of, you can't compare that to ordinary cases. And third, this court has spoken in two published opinions, one that Judge Petty, you were on the panel for, and that's the Farrell versus Warren County case out of 2012. And in that case, the court said, quote, when an appeal is taken from the circuit court involving termination of parental rights, de novo hearing on the merits, the case, it says, is obligated to be held within those 90 days. That is a published opinion. Your Honors are pointing us to unpublished cases that say it's direct.
Does obligated mean that if it does not, then the case is dismissed?
Well, maybe, maybe not. But I will point the court to the Strong versus Hampton case. And in that particular case, doesn't involve the 90-day rule. It involves my second argument, the procedure on the other. This court said you've got to follow the letter of the law when you're doing termination of parental rights, when you're taking people's kids away. You've got to follow, due process requires it, strict compliance. Those were the exact words, strict compliance from the statutory scheme.
Your argument then would require us to reverse and dismiss.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what we're asking the court to do. And if the department feels that termination is in the best interest, they need to follow the proper procedure and go back through the juvenile court and follow
the... Let me just ask you a question that maybe you don't think is appropriate, don't want to answer this trying, but it suggests to me that position on certain aspects of the statute that deals with the termination of parental rights, if we take your position on it, it's arguably inconsistent with the best interests of some children.
Right.
And I know there's at least one case that had nothing to do with termination, had to do with, I think, relocation, actually.
Okay.
I wrote it. I know that. That doesn't mean it was mine. Because we all do it together, you
sure.
know that. But that's the... I don't know that it's up to this court, as an intermediate court of appeals, to deal with such a question. I know you could argue that's a policy issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so sure that that what is a reasonable effect mm-hmm. of an argument shouldn't be considered. Now, I understand you could say, well, it's in the best interest of the children to keep them intact
right.
with their family. Okay. However, there are many children who, if kept in that status, are at risk. That's why DSS is involved.
Right.
They may not be at risk of death, but they're at risk. So if we apply some of the statutory requirements strictly, the question is that necessarily consistent with the overall purpose of these statutes, which is to protect the interests of the child? You know, when you come to this kind of case, mom and dad are important, but the child trumps everything.
Sure.
I mean, that's a bit of shorthand. Do you know where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I do. And I respect that, and I don't disagree generally. But I do want to bring up a couple, three different points. One, this court has said in a couple different cases, we need to construe these statutes to favor parents to a certain degree as well. And the rights of parents should be favored. Now, the second bit is strict compliance with this framework does not prevent the court from doing other things. For instance, this court looked at, in the Black case, Black versus, I think it was Charlottesville, Your Honor was on the panel for that case, a mom came in and said, they didn't give me a continuance, I wanted a continuance, and the judge said, no, this child needs permanency, this child needs to, we need to get this case over with, I'm not giving you a continuance. And I've asked for a continuance as a parent's attorney before, and the judge said no. I think this promotes the best interest of the child when we look at what this court asks for in other respects. It's not in the best interest of the child to forevermore wonder if their parent's going to get it together. And by saying procedurally, jurisdictionally, circuit court, you must have these cases done, or at least start the evidence and then continue it on to promote the best interest of the child. And what happened in this case is DSS showed up and they weren't ready. They showed up for the case and they said, I'm going to need to subpoena more witnesses, my guys aren't here. And what should have happened, if you're applying the rules strictly, is they should have been compelled to move forward that day. Or they should have said, well, we'll start over in juvenile court and do it right.
Mr. Slump, you're pretty deep into your time. You might want to address your other issues.
I will, thank you.
Issues,
unless
please.
There's further question on
well,
that point.
I just wanted to make sure that you had addressed the prejudice.
Yes.
You had at one point said that
yes.
there were three points you wanted
right.
to make on prejudice. And
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll try my best to jump back to the other. All of this relates to each other because the due process procedural argument applies to the other as well. And we believe the strict compliance should be as to both. There are various cases, for instance, the Strong versus Hamilton case, or Hampton case, that does not require a showing of prejudice. And so it's a little bit odd to ask a parent to show prejudice in a 90-day rule, but not in the other rule. There was just no prejudice shown or required with regard to the filing of a foster care plan.
I take it your response is there is no evidence of prejudice in this case.
No, not necessarily. I think there is prejudice. We look at January 20th or 30th when this case was heard and then move forward to the next date, March 17th. The department subpoenaed 11 witnesses. The grandmother's custody petition that had been pending at the time of the January hearing and we were going to rely on was dismissed by the time you got to March. There were additional criminal things that came up, which would be his fault, but still, he was prejudiced between that date and the end. Things were different. The department should have moved forward with their case at that date. Otherwise, they should have gone back to juvenile court and proved their case below. Moving to my second point, and that is there is a framework that says you've got to file a foster care plan, it's got to be considered, it's got to be approved, it's got to recommend termination of parental rights and adoption. And in this case, they did file that, and it was appealed. That appeal, and that particular part of it, the permanency planning order, was not addressed by the circuit court in its order. It was not focused in on at the circuit court level when we had the case, the termination case. And we would argue, if you read the Strong case, if you read Stanley versus Fairfax, if you read the Campbell County versus Wright case, those cases focusing in on foster care plan as a building block to termination. And you think about it in terms of you're building a house towards the termination. The foundation is you've got to have this foster care plan that fundamentally at the outset says we believe termination is the best interest of the child. And there's other required factual findings.
If I understand correctly, the only one the case relied on was the juvenile court plan.
Yes, and it was appealed.
That's your argument. Then it went up to circuit court.
Right.
There was not another plan filed.
No.
Do I understand the argument?
Correct. There was not another plan filed, and there was not another plan approved. And I would say, based on the appeal de novo, wipes out the prior court's approval and the filing of that as if it never happened. And the fact the circuit court said, didn't even consider it, didn't look at it, just terminated parental rights, I think you're putting the roof on the house before you build the foundation. You have, according to the statutory framework and reading this court's decisions in the Strong case, Strong is very strong because it says you must do these things or else. Unless
All
there's
right.
further questions, I'll reserve the rest.
You've got a few moments left. Thank you very
Jim.
Much.
Morning.
morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Quinn.
My name is Jeremy O'Quinn. I represent the Wise County Department of Social Services in this case, and we are asking that the court affirm the trial court's rulings.
Could I jump right in?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you address this last issue about the plan, the permanency plan being filed only in the juvenile court and then proceeding the circuit court based on that filing?
Yes, ma'am.
And by the way, de novo hearings, basically, the evidence doesn't come up at all. It's not supposed to even be considered, is it?
Basically, what happened in this particular case is what happens in every case.
Well, I think that's probably right, but I still wonder how you can rely on something filed in the general district juvenile domestic relations court.
Mm-hmm.
When I think all the rules suggest you can't carry forward that file.
Well, and in this particular case, the plan was introduced. The record was introduced. The juvenile court record was introduced. It's in the appendix.
In the circuit court.
It was, yes. And in this particular case, the plan, Mr. Slim alleges that there was no evidence presented about the plan. In fact, the proffer that I made specifically references the parent's inability to follow the foster care plan. And the stipulation that counsel then came up and agreed that there were sufficient facts to terminate for parental rights.
It was introduced in the circuit court without objection?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And it's in the appendix.
Was there a change of goal to termination filed?
From the lower court, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Essentially, the plans go through the lower court, and once they get to lower court, the court changes goal and enters a termination order. Then appellant's counsel correctly appealed those orders, the permanency planning order and the order from the termination to the circuit court.
And then the plan sets out the requirements of the parents in order to meet the then goal of generally return to parent.
Yes, that initial foster care plan sets out the return to home goal.
If they aren't able to remedy then the circumstances that started the process within the statutory 1 year period, then that's the basis for termination.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any case where that statute that you file a new plan in circuit court and then you get another 1 year to comply with that plan before the circuit court can terminate?
Never, Your Honor, and I think that goes contrary to the best interest of the child. Both this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly ruled that these time frames are crucial to a child. A child cannot just be left in limbo over and over again wondering whether their parents are going to get things together. So these time frames are very important to the child. In this particular case, the only issue appealed was the permanency planning order and the termination. In other words, the initial foster care plan is not appealed. That's a final order. It was never appealed. When we go to termination and permanency planning, that's the only thing that are appealed. Counsel has suggested that there must be a separate permanency planning order, and I would say that is contrary to what the statute says.
Because once the juvenile and domestic relations district court enters the order of termination of parental rights, the plan becomes irrelevant.
It essentially is harmless error anyway. If they terminate parental rights, even if the court were to find that the permanency planning order is somehow wrong, it's essentially harmless error because the parental rights at that point have been terminated if they're separate issues.
In any event, you offered that into evidence at the circuit court?
Yes, sir. Okay. The circuit court, it's part of the appendix, okay. Judge. Now, moving on, I guess, to the second issue, or the first issue that Mr. Slint brought up, since we kind of went backwards there. But Mr. Slint brings up 16-1-296D, and the court, I think, correctly cites to the Daniels case, which is an unpublished opinion, but was issued November of last year, I believe. And it goes into an analysis involving whether the statute is mandatory and jurisdictional or procedural and directory, and comes to the conclusion that it's procedural and directory. Once the court makes that conclusion, and it based ruling on two published opinions, I believe it's Jamborski, and I probably murdered that name, but Harris were the two opinions involving 16-1-296B.
Also Morrison, Supreme Court, in our case. Morrison.
Yes, ma'am.
Also.
There were several opinions that it based that ruling on. So once it came, you come to that conclusion that it's procedural and directory, then you must show actual prejudice. So you must have a showing of prejudice. Of course, Mr. Slimps made allegations that there were prejudice in this particular case because additional witnesses might have been subpoenaed and his client was arrested in the time frame between the initial hearing and the second hearing. What we'll never know is what those witnesses would have said. And the reason we won't know that is because we walked into court that day, I proffered our evidence, and he stipulated to it. Once that happens, once a stipulation is entered that the evidence is sufficient to terminate parental rights, he can't take that away. That is something that is a final decision at that point. It's a final finding of fact. It carries the same weight as a jury finding or a judge finding. The Supreme Court's repeatedly ruled on that. This court's repeatedly ruled on that. So in our finding, there cannot be a showing of actual prejudice because of the stipulation.
Well, you're separating the entrustment agreement, which was revoked, mm-hmm. from the stipulation, which was not and could not. It was an agreement that was binding.
Correct. Mr. Slimp does make a reference that somehow, I guess, the stipulation must have been conditional upon his entry of the entrustment agreement. Therefore, if he revokes the entrustment agreement, it revokes the stipulation. What I would say is, clearly, based on the proffer and what we told the court, that is not the case. In other words, the reason the proffer was made was to the court, in case he revokes this entrustment agreement, Judge, we're entering this proffer.
I recall reading that in the transcript.
Yes, sir. That's all I have regarding those two issues. I wanted to reserve some time for the guardian to speak. Thank you.
Ms. Kern?
Thank you, Jeremy. Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Stephanie Kern, and I'm the guardian ad litem for the infant child, Calvin Boatwright. And I wouldn't presuppose to try to be more eloquent than my esteemed colleague that's representing the father in this case. I would just like to state in general that I believe the evidence is overwhelming that the best interest of the child would be served by acceptance of the foster care plan with the goal of termination of rights, of parental rights, and the rights being terminated and pursuit of the adoption by the wonderful foster home that currently has the child. And then I'm willing to field any questions to the best of my abilities.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being here today.
Oh,
we have too many
you.
GALs that don't fulfill the obligation of carrying these cases through. We appreciate it.
And I do wish to apologize to the court, too, that I didn't go to the tenuous extremes of listing out everything so that we could avoid some of the
brevity is appreciated.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Slamp, you've got a few moments left for rebuttal.
I'll remember that comment, that brevity is important. I do have a couple points.
It's not rewarded necessarily, but it is appreciated.
I understand. With regard to the plan, opposing counsel made reference to the initial plan and the admission of the plan as evidence. I think what's important to note is that the initial plan had a goal of return to own home. Then they filed a second plan with the goal of termination. That determination by the juvenile court that the termination and adoption is the appropriate goal was objected to, was appealed.
But once the order for termination of parental rights is entered, doesn't that plan become irrelevant because there's nothing further to do?
Well, that may be correct. However, the statutory scheme says you've got to have it, you've got to have the hearing, it's got to be approved.
And all of that was done, and then the order of termination entered in the juvenile court. That's the order that's being reviewed now in the circuit court, whether there was sufficient evidence to terminate parental rights.
But they were both appealed. And like all appeals from the district court,
he hears the first one and he hears the termination appeal and decides that we've said that you don't even need to address the planning appeal because that is now moot.
Well, I respectfully disagree because, for instance, in the Strong case, it was not harmless error when they tried to terminate parental rights and yet they didn't have the foster care plan in place.
So is it your position that the circuit court has to go back and redo everything that was done? There has to be a plan that has a goal return to parents, and then we have to wait another year to see if the parents can fulfill those obligations?
No, Your Honor. I'm not asking the court to require an additional year. We don't believe that's in the best interest of the children. But what we do say is the law's pretty clear. You've got to have this plan that says termination's in the best interest. That decision, these decisions, there's cases out there that say that decision has to be approved by the juvenile court. And if it's appealed, that foundation from which the termination can rest has to be re-reviewed by the circuit court. It's just review of what's happened in the past year by the circuit court, not a new whole year.
Well, isn't the appeal that should take place if you're talking about the validity of the plan, mm-hmm. is the appeal that should happen when the change in goal is noted.
Right, and that's what happened. And the circuit court was treating them all at the same time.
Well, I thought that there was a change in goal,
right.
And that the juvenile court then entered the termination of parental rights.
And we appealed it. They did everything together in juvenile court. It was all done together, and it was all done together in circuit court.
But the appeal, the error then would be the juvenile court erred in approving the change in goal.
Well, because it's de novo, the circuit court, well, yes, the juvenile court changed the goal. We appealed it de novo. The circuit court didn't touch it. And so you can't have this without the bottom.
I understand your argument.
And it's not harmless error because a strong case says that argument, I believe, was even made in that case because you can't have one without the other.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We will greet counsel and then